In a world where multi-million dollar satellites are used to find Tupperware in the woods, through the magic of the internet, which is just a series of tubes, coming to you from the surface of planet Earth, the Slaga Geocaching Podcast is about to begin.
This is a Slaga Geocaching Podcast, produced by Paul Konopacki of St. Louis, Missouri. February the 24th, 2007. Episode number 55. Interview with geocachers Thistle and Justified.
Welcome to episode number 55 of the Slaga Geocaching Podcast. This podcast is published under the Creative Commons No Derivative License. To contact me about these episodes, send an email to podcast@geostl.com. I try to publish two episodes a month, each around 30 minutes in length. I have in-depth discussions with geocachers about their life and hobbies. Sometimes I get audio in the field during geocaching events. Today's interview is with Thistle and Justified, a geocaching couple who recently moved into the St. Louis area. Thistle talks about medieval reenactment and astronomy. Justified talks about ham radio and the telecommunication industry. During the podcast, if you hear this sound, it means there's been a break in the conversation or a change in physical location. Now, on with the show. This is Paul Konopacki, and we're sitting in my dining room on a very blustery day. And you might even be able to hear some of the wind blowing as we're talking here. I have David and Thistle in front of me, two geocachers who recently came to the St. Louis area. I'm going to find out a little bit about their past and some of their recent geocaching conquests.
This is Dave. Just got to St. Louis, would have been the beginning of December. Came in from a job transfer. I work for a phone company, transferred in from the Denver area. Originally started geocaching out of Ohio, and that was in 2001.
Hi, this is Thistle. I came to St. Louis with Dave from the Denver area. I originally started caching in, the geocache site says 2003, but I didn't actually pick up a GPS unit and start caching until 2004.
Besides geocaching, what were you doing in Ohio?
Majority of my life was Ohio, just outside of Cleveland. At the time that we started geocaching, we had known each other from previous times. We were on our separate routes. Now we are back together.
I'm a nomad. I originally started out in Connecticut and then moved to Nantucket Island and then Texas, Florida, New York City, Colorado, Arizona.
Was that a traveling spirit you had in you, or were jobs taking you in places?
A little bit of both. Jobs, school, just a need to get away from whatever.
Individually, how did you get interested in geocaching?
One of the original definitions that I remember of geocaching was a cache was to be placed out of the way that people would not normally get to, and this was what was supposed to bring them to those areas so that they could observe something either unusual, scenic, or along that line. Now, mind you, I think that's quite changed over the years. Now that you have caches every 500 feet along a trail, that's not quite bringing someone to a scenic area per se, but that was my original draw. I actually had read an article on letterboxing, and while researching letterboxing on the internet, I ran across geocaching, and I happened to own a GPS at that time, and I was like, I can go do both.
What were you using your GPS receiver for prior to knowing about geocaching?
Not a heck of a lot. I had it probably from 99, 98, before the restriction on the GPS signal had been lifted so that you could get a better position on stuff. Can't remember too much of what I was doing with it. I remember it was sitting on a shelf for a lot of the time because of the fact it wasn't as accurate as I wanted it to be. I wasn't much of a hiker per se because in the area of Ohio I was in, there wasn't much to go hiking in.
A couple of years after Dave and I broke up, I happened to find his website on the internet, and I was like, oh, let's see what Dave is doing. And, you know, you can see that he's involved in a relationship with somebody else, but somewhere on the website it mentioned geocaching. So I went to geocaching and read the front page, and I said, oh boy, this is so cool. So I signed up. About a year or two later, my, at the time, boyfriend bought me a GPS unit for my birthday. Didn't have any way of downloading caches, so I hand-programmed it. Took his roommate out to a cache called Fly Away in West Palm Beach, and it was a micro cache on a Malleoluca tree, and we found it. And I was hooked from that moment on.
Because you travel all over, have you noticed the difference in the types of caches or the hide?
The first thing I noticed about this area is that the puzzle caches and some of the not puzzle caches, somebody will say, use your GPS to orienteer a point 310 degrees off the true north and go 512 feet, and I've never learned how to do that. Oh. But it seems everybody here does that. In Jacksonville, everybody puts urban micros. If you go out to Arizona, it's remote canyons. They have to put the altitude on the coordinates so you know how high up or down the canyon or the mountain you're looking for the cache on.
Okay.
And so there's very, very different caches in different parts of the country.
How many caches have you guys done here in St. Louis since you got here?
13?
I'm going to say in that neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you also have something in common, this medieval reenactment?
There's different organizations throughout the country that do different types of reenactment. Most people are more familiar with the Civil War reenactors. But there's also medieval reenactors of different types. I belonged to a reenactment group called the Society for Creative Anachronism. Once a year, they have a huge, I guess you would call it party, because that's what it is, party out in Pennsylvania called Penzic, and they get 10,000 people a year.
Technically, it's classified as a war amongst different states, different groups between states.
So like individual chapters that all come together in one great big annual event?
And it's not all the same organization either. It's not just the Society for Creative Anachronism. There are other reenactment groups, including the one he belonged to at the time. I think it was 92. I went out and was walking around late one night, came across his encampment and met him and just pretty much love at first sight.
Now, you're all in costumes at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And you wore those costumes the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
How is this different than the Renaissance?
The difference between these is, think of it as more of what you see on the combat field with the horses, except for this, you know, 10,000 people, you don't use horses. There are no horses involved. The original intent of that particular event was who controlled the state of Pennsylvania for the year, who the membership would affect. Was it the, you know, Ohio, Kentucky, Michigan, Illinois section, or did the membership belong to the East Coast states? So that was how Pennsylvania's membership was decided, was at this event. I think it was the loser got Pennsylvania, but that was beside the point.
Loser got Pittsburgh.
Well, how do you determine a winner? Is it any long, points, any historical lines?
Or? No, it was strictly results of the combat events. Overall winner of the archery tournaments, overall winner of the single tournaments, overall major battle winners.
Physical competition.
Yes, it's physical competition. You've got 5,000 guys out there in full plate armor.
And girls.
Basically hitting each other with rattan sticks. So a form of bamboo, that heavy, full-grade bamboo that's solid. That's why they're wearing the full plate armor. You know, there are sets of rules. Hit to the head, walk off the field. Hit to the body, a good hit to the body. You walk off the field.
And they have referees there.
There are referees, and you've got medics on site the entire time.
What got you both interested in that?
I'm a scrapper. I like to fight. Using a little bit of distance between myself and my opponents, I usually fight with a quarterstaff or a bow and arrow. I like the fact that it does have rules that you usually don't get hurt. I enjoy the fighting. I like the social aspects. I like the history. My persona is a Mongolian, so I've done a lot of Mongol and Chinese history, learning about the different cultures, learning some of the Chinese language.
Does that mean that then at these events like this, you hang out with people who are also Mongolian?
sometimes, and sometimes you want to hang out with the people that aren't so you can learn their weaknesses.
It was my job that brought us to St. Louis.
I was in Arizona when we got back together. He was in Denver, and I was in Arizona at school, and we had been communicating since I left Florida, actually, because I called him during one of the hurricanes when I could hear a tree rolling up the roof.
Not down the roof, but up the roof.
I figured if I was going to die, I just wanted to call him one last time and say, hi, survived it, no problem. Survived the 2 weeks afterwards with no electricity or water and all that.
I work for a telephone company. A minimum of a year I'll be here because that's how much time I have to go before. If I were to leave my job before that of my own volition, I would have to pay them back the moving expenses. So far, this job is much less stressful than my last position. I work in a national operations center, maintaining the backbone for a medium-sized phone company.
Is it downtown?
No, it's in Maryland Heights. In our facility also is a lot of central office equipment. Each of those have their own generator. Like I said, we monitor the backbone, the big fiber backbone for it. What would be called an OC-192, and have never physically worked in a piece of equipment. Everything I do is remote. I call up technicians and they become my eyes and hands. As with telecom, I take nothing for granted. I have been through 4 layoffs amongst different companies since I started in telecommunications.
Were you hit real hard around 2000? They were putting fiber everywhere with no end in sight.
When the phone company started out, they went to the investors and said, we're going to ask for money now. We're just going to build us out partially. Then we're going to come back and ask for money a second time. That's going to finish it. They made their big rush, got as far as they could, and then they went back to the investment companies and said, okay, it's time for the second round of money. Investment companies went, we haven't seen any money from the first time. There's no return on our investment yet. You're not going to get any more money. And at that point, they all went, if we can't finish, we can't produce money, period. And that began the chain cycle of bankruptcy after bankruptcy after bankruptcy.
I was working at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. I've been working mostly in planetariums for, well, since 84, 85. Well, I was an astronomer for a while. I worked for Van Vleck Observatory out of Middletown. It's associated with Wesleyan University. And what I did with them was I would go up and use the big telescope to photograph stars 6 months apart, and what we would do is use parallax to determine how far our solar system was from these other stars. Parallax is just using triangulation, and you're using the Earth's orbit to determine through triangulation how far these other stars are. Our sun is moving at pretty much the same speed as all the stars that are around us, and we're moving around the edge of our galaxy. We're about two-thirds of the way out from the very center of the galaxy, and there's a massive black hole, and everything's kind of swirling around that black hole in the center, like when you stir your coffee cup, and there's that little dimple in the center, and all the foam goes around and around. You can think of our solar system and all the stars around us as that foam that's going around and around.
And we're the Milky Way galaxy.
Yes, we are the Milky Way galaxy. That's because if you can go out on a really dark night away from any city lights and look up, you see this cloud that goes across the sky, and that's not a cloud of water, that's a cloud of stars.
Yeah.
And it looks like a path of milk spilled across the sky.
Unfortunately, around here, you have to go a ways away to find that.
The best two occurrences I've seen for that particular view were Dinosaur National Park out at the edge of Colorado and Utah, and a small little campsite actually on the side of the road in Idaho. We were heading towards Yellowstone and just picked a campsite at random, and there was just right across the sky, and you're going, wow.
I carry my telescope with me. I have a small one that weighs about 30 pounds, and then a big one that's taller than I am. Usually one of those telescopes is either in my car or nearby, or binoculars. I don't go anywhere without binoculars because there's stuff that you can see with binoculars that just looks horrible in a telescope. Yeah, that was astronomy, and then planetariums are where you try to teach astronomy to lay people. There's a nice planetarium here. We have the McDonald Planetarium. I don't work there yet. I keep crossing my fingers. I would say it's an 80-foot dome. I've worked in 6 planetariums, and this one's one of the nicest.
So the planetarium is kind of an artificial sky.
And the one in Denver could literally bring you outside the galaxy and show you what deep space would look like. Most of them just show you what stars you can see here, and they can make adjustments for time. Like the North Star that we have now was not the North Star back when the Egyptians were building their pyramids. It was a different star. It was a star called Thuban. Because our Earth, as it rotates, it kind of wobbles a little bit like a top. So the North Star does gradually change over a period of 25, 30,000 years. 30,000 years from now, our North Star won't be the North Star anymore.
You know, I don't think I've ever looked through a very large telescope. If I'm looking at a star like Betelgeuse, what do I see different than when I look up in the sky? Just a bigger piece of light?
It looks like a dot. When you look at a star through a telescope, it's pretty boring unless there's something special about that star. I'm going to use our sun as an example, but do not look at the sun through a telescope. It's very, very bad. Our sun, for example, if you did have the right filters to look at our sun's pretty interesting. If you look at it at different wavelengths of light, like hydrogen alpha is one that most people get a special filter for their telescopes, you can see the actual surface of the sun and how it moves. The sun, you can think of the surface of the sun, it's made out of plasma and gases, but it behaves like the surface of boiling water because you have convection currents coming up from below and things cooling at the surface is sinking back in. You've got twisted magnetic fields. You've got ions bursting into space.
If I segue back into geocaching, how would a solar flare, have they affected satellite and even telecommunications?
There's cycles on the sun. They can have profound effects on satellites. They can actually knock out the electricity to a satellite. You can think of it as rubbing a magnet back and forth on a power line. It can affect that power line, so you can lose satellite communication. Back in 1859, back when the telegraph was just introduced, there was a huge solar flare that not only knocked out telegraph communications, but was so powerful that the lines overheated and started prairie fires.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a pretty profound effect.
And you can't hide from that either, right?
Yeah, it doesn't hurt people, though, because here on Earth, we're super lucky. We have a magnetic field that goes all the way around our planet, and that protects us from most of the stuff that the sun's throwing at us, because it can either toss it away from the Earth or catch it and pull it in towards the Earth at the poles. So there's very specific areas where there's more of an effect from the sun. That's where you get your aurora borealis or aurora australis, at the poles where it's pulling it in or pushing it away.
Do you remember learning in school something about the Van Allen belts?
Yes.
Does that have something to do with the protective
layer? That protects us, layer? Definitely.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Van Allen belts are part of our magnetic field. You can think of it as two big donuts that go around the Earth, roughly around the equator. They're belts around the Earth, and then there's these other magnetic shells. They're part of our magnetosphere.
And in the next 5.5 years, it will get worse. It's an 11-year cycle.
So find them now while you can.
And they are expecting this one to be one of the more active cycles.
So how do you think that would affect if I'm going around looking for a cache in the woods?
Most of the time shouldn't have any problem. If you know your satellite information about geocaching, there are a number of backups already in place.
Redundancy.
Yes, there is a full redundancy because the military relies on this. That's the primary use for it.
We're just lucky
we get to play with the military's toys, and we nod our head and smile every day for that.
Have you been to any SLOG events since you've been here?
I went to the SLAGA event Eureka. Cabin Fever. We actually met Crow's Feet and Strider one day when we tried to be the first to find for Biology 101, and we were second to find. And as we were leaving, Strider and Crow's Feet were coming up. They mentioned SLAGA to us and got us involved. You know, we've come across a couple of those puzzle caches. I have small geocaching goals that I want to meet while I'm here. And one of my goals is, from my home location, have an entire page of caches with the check mark on it. So instead of filtering out the finds, did not have the check mark. And two of the caches on my page have not been found in a year. One of them's a mean gene.
There's one called Global, which he made you project around the world. It's like, oh, how could that end up bringing you to a certain spot in the woods in Bluebird Park? Sure enough, it did.
Yeah, the other one that has us stumped right now is Where's the Cache?
But we've got the coordinates for it. We just have to find it.
There's been
have
some changes. Yeah.
We, late in the evening one day, it was getting duskish, and we didn't quite catch that one.
Yeah, that one's got a lot of downed tree limbs from that last ice storm. We know the cache owner checked on it in the beginning of January, so it's still there.
I was going to say, we know Zeeble.
He works with Zeeble, and I've typed back and forth with Ferry G a couple times.
I don't know if you've heard of this event coming up in March called MOGA, which is Midwest's Open Geocaching Adventure.
We are planning on attending. You know, if nothing else, it's a camping trip.
There is a whole segment of geocaching amateur radio operators.
What's your call sign?
My call sign's Kilo Bravo 8 Papa X-Ray Victor, or KB8 PXV. Technician class, only not upgraded because of problems hearing Morse code tones. Now, as of Friday, it became a mute point because the FCC removed that as part of the testing process.
As far as requiring Morse code?
Morse code became a no longer requirement for any ham radio license. There's three levels of licensing still. Technician is the basic course. I've had that license for 13 years.
There's a guy, and I think he will be at MOGA. Last year, he's from Duluth, Minnesota, and you can go on the internet. He has a little call signs on this little icon of a car, and as he's driving along...
It's APRS, Amateur Position Reporting System. You'll find KB8PXV-7 running around with a little pickup truck. That's the most active offshoot of that original digital network that I've got involved for. Actually, I have a little handheld radio that can sit on my hip. It talks to the GPS so that I've got looking for a cache programmed. It's feeding my current position to that radio, which is then broadcasting it out. So if I were to get lost, you can actually go to findyou.com, look up that address, and you'll find where that radio is broadcasting from. I'm out on my own. She can actually keep track of me. Don't have it on always. I'm not into Big Brother, you know, keeping an eye on me all the time. It's only on certain occasions I run it.
How's your GPS communicating with your radio? What kind of GPS receiver do you have?
I have three different GPSs at this point. My primary one is a Garmin eTrex, the yellow. Basically, you set it, instead of for Garmin communications, you set it for NEMA, N-M-E-A, 4800 baud. It just sends a packet of data. The radio has a built-in TNC and software in it to read that packet, process it, and ship it out through the radio as a different string of data for software, APRS software, to decode. It is a 2-meter rig broadcasting on 144.39 megahertz FM. I pump out anywhere from 1 watt to 5 watts with that radio, depending on what I want to set it for. The different operators will have what's called a digipeater up. Think of it like a cell tower. Somebody gets a packet in, they take it and rebroadcast. You could be in the middle of nowhere and there just happens to be a ham radio operator that picks up your transmission if he's set up for
a nice enough guy to have that antenna just in case you need it.
He just has that antenna out there and just happens to have that software running. I've been on the middle of a mountainside, turned on the APRS, and I'll get a packet confirmation back. And I'm going, there's nobody around for 30 miles. When it's driving around the truck, I have an external antenna on it. It gets a much better range as a result.
Now, how's the 2-meter different in the GMRS?
FRS is family radio service. It is a free service. You can buy the radio. You can use it for free. There's no licensing involved. Don't expect to get more than a mile. End of statement.
You talk to your kids at the water park.
At the mall. Yeah. You got 6 million people on it. Don't expect privacy. Don't expect anything. GMRS, General Something Radio Service. $75 license per person. Renewable every...
Five years,
is it? Get caught not having your license and operating on GMRS. Welcome to approximately $5,000 to $10,000 in fines.
But believe it or not, they sell a lot of GMRS bubble packs at Walmart.
They all have little footnotes.
Yeah.
You must read what you're buying. If you don't,
but
you
it looks
are
like
responsible.
It looks like a walkie-talkie.
It is a walkie-talkie. And they package FRS and GMRS radios together. You know, the same radio can operate on both frequencies. I have one. I only operate on the FRS. my ham radio license does not give me GMRS. Separate license, completely. GMRS will get you 5, 10. You're still limited on wattage.
5 watts.
Yeah, something like that. You know, they'll claim 17-mile range. Yeah, if you're standing on top of the mountain and the guy's down over there from the line of sight because of altitude, yeah, that's how you're getting 17 miles.
Under optimal conditions, which is never
exactly.
Reality.
There's a competition back in Colorado. It's the 14er Club. The guys take up little handheld 2-meter rigs and will stand on the top of a 14,000-foot mountain and broadcast in simplex, which is without the use of a repeater. And they see how far they can throw the signal.
That's pretty geeky.
There are times where I was sitting at the apartment back in Denver on what's called 6 meters, 50 megahertz. It was a good day, and all of a sudden I just had the radio on, just listening, and you could hear it basically stretch out the atmospheric conditions. First you'd heard Mississippi. And then you heard Florida. And then just as fast, it closed right back up again.
When you were talking about what you were listening to, you didn't even mention the International Space Station or SUSAT. The parts I found fascinating was he's actually listened to the astronauts on the space station
as
they go overhead.
I've heard two-way conversations with Ansari while she was up there. I've got recordings of them on my website. Recordings from Bill MacArthur on 2-meter FM. Doing the data packets. When the computer's active properly up on the space station, I try to bounce packets off of it through digi repeater and see how far I can make a two-way contact. So far from Denver, I've gotten Florida, New Hampshire, and Cancun, Mexico. Once again, it's throwing data packets.
And somebody else sitting there waiting to do that. Same
yep.
thing. Waiting to see who's out there. What's your website?
www.kb8pxv. Kilo Bravo 8, Papa X-ray Victor, .com. There's another aspect of it that's called fox hunting. Put a transmitter out and then use radios to triangulate to find that broadcasting thing. When I was at a camping trip back in Denver, a couple of the radio operators set up a fox hunt geocache. So you had to use your GPS to get to certain points, and then you fox hunted to get to another point to sign the log to claim the cache. I was standing there in the middle of the woods, using the radio for the fox hunt, and I'm going, okay, and my partner's pointing behind me and laughing. I'm standing right in front of the tree that's got the fox on it. Ham radio and geocaching can fit together so easily.
I'd like to see a little bit more of that happening in the St. Louis area. Well, I appreciate you guys coming here on short notice.
He's a lot of fun to cache with. I've been places that I would never have dreamed of going.
We've been on the top of some ridges in Colorado where the view from those ridges is just spectacular, and you can only get there on 4x4 trails. The cache is 20 feet from a 1,000-foot drop, and you're looking down at this just beautiful landscape.
This area is gorgeous in its own way.
I mean, you've got
beautiful forests. You've got caves. I'm really into caves.
Well, I appreciate it, guys.
It's going to be nice camping without grizzly bears. We're camping without alligators.
You'll have deer prancing through the woods.
We had elk bugling behind us in Yellowstone.
Volunteer at the zoo in Prescott, Arizona, and we were part of the species survival plan for the Mexican wolf. We had three brothers at our zoo, and they're beautiful, very intelligent animals. Horribly endangered in Arizona and Mexico because ranchers just shoot them.
We can let you discover our geocoins. Never really collected geocoins until that Slaga thing, and everybody had their geocoins there, and they're like, here, you can discover this. But it's like,
yeah.
Ooh, okay.
Crowsey 30, she's really into them. Roger Barnes is another person.
Let's see, Gerhardus is the one who he had like a book of geocoins. My Colorado one's actually in a cache in California. I didn't have the sense to hang on to it. I got to get New Hampshire next. I've been trying to collect these as I've hiked through the states that have the AT in them.
Yeah, Mo's going to have one. Slog has been talking about having one as well. Mm-hmm. It's some people say that the popularity is waning. Some people say it's just as hot as it ever was.
I like the coins. I don't like the fact that people steal them. If people are going to put good money into putting something out like that,
that and travel bugs. Why steal a travel bug?
There was a guy in Colorado that was pilfering travel bars. They had hundreds of them missing.
And one day he showed up and handed over all the TB tags.
Well, no, he showed up before the event occurred. Didn't leave the travel box. He left all the tags. Put a bag on the table where the picnic was going to be and left. So they don't know who it was.
Yes, they do. I was talking before we left Colorado, that last event I went to in Colorado. They knew who it was.
Okay.
They actually did talk to him, but they're saying he left a bag on the table because they don't want to reveal who it is, obviously, because they're doing all sorts of revenge.
Yeah, threats.
Yeah.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.